All right, it's time to bring up our next speaker. I have a question for you. How many people here have done time for the libertarian belief, even a day in jail? Are you really sure?
Not a day, I just what happened. Yeah.
Okay. Our next speaker has done time not once but twice for his libertarian belief. He's really walked the talk. Paul Jacobs is a national leading advocate of civilian control of government. He is the president of Citizens in Charge, which is a direct action organization for the education and promotion of ballot initiatives and referenda. He used to be a leader in the term limits movement as the president of the group U.S. Term Limits. A day or two in jail in Oklahoma?
3 hours.
Oh, okay. For having a canary for petitioning in Oklahoma. And in the 80s, he refused to sign up for the draft, and he did 5 months for that. He was in charge of the Ron Paul petition gathering when he was in 88 when he ran for president of the GOP presidential candidate. He was a former member of the LNC and a former executive director of the Libertarian Party. And he's here to tell us today about how you have the right to shut up and pay your taxes. Paul Jacobs, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much. I think it may have been George Bernard Shaw who suggested that Irish folks like me didn't have any talent, so we just had to get in trouble. That was our claim to fame. I want to talk today about the right to shut up and pay your taxes, but I have to admit that is almost always the subject that I give almost any talk I make. And part of that is you get asked to give a talk and you're not sure what you're going to talk on, and I figure that subject pretty much sums up our political situation, and that's usually what I'm talking about in one way or another. As Bob pointed out, you know, I have years ago I got in a tussle because of draft registration. I really found a very welcome place. I was a libertarian before I managed to get myself in hot water, but this political party all over the country was a very, very welcome home. And you know, anybody, you know, libertarians were always self-analyzing, or maybe better put, analyzing the guy next to us. And so we're very critical and we're very opinionated, and we're not, you know, slow to complain or criticize the Libertarian Party. But boy, I have to tell you, in every fiber of my being, when I think of the Libertarian Party, I think of thank you. Because as a very young man facing some difficult circumstances, this party walked the walk as well as talking the talk. I probably should have called this talk the Ten Commandments for Pro-Liberty Activists, because looking at political activity, last weekend I was at the Virginia Libertarian Party, and it happened to be my 50th birthday, so now I can give up any pretense of being young. But you know, I was kind of looking back at some of the different activities, and that's what led me to think of some of these commandments, which, like any good commandments, apply to me as they do to you and everybody else. And so let me just go through what I see as the Ten Commandments for pro-liberty activists. Works for libertarians, works for anybody who wants to expand freedom. And if you don't want to expand freedom, I'm hoping it doesn't work for you. The first commandment is to do something. And this is, you know, this is easy. And the whole list is easy, trust me. But sometimes we forget it. You know, it's like the days at work. You ever have days at work where you're busy the whole day and then you look at your list to do and you realize, I didn't get anything on that list done? And sometimes that's okay. And then sometimes that's not so okay. But sometimes the do something part, we forget to get done. And when I used to work for the Ballot Access Committee of the Libertarian Party, one of the jobs I had was contacting state chairmen when they take over and have a talk about ballot access and get a general feel for what are they going to do. And I would ask them, what are you going to do? And I would generally hear two responses. I would hear, well, we're going to do X and so. Whether it was a candidate race or fight the city council on something or the state legislature, what have you. The other thing I heard was, we're going to get organized. My sense, and this wasn't true in every case, but somewhere there's still a state chairman trying to get organized. I have to admit I have a bias where it comes to organization because I'm not organized. I married somebody organized. I try to work with people organized. Most of the things that I've gotten accomplished in my life, it's because I went to do something, and then somebody who was organized said, Paul, would you just step aside for a second so I could come in and get it organized? And I think that that's the way it should be. We have all different kinds of people, but the key is to do something. Because you don't attract the doers and the activists if what you're doing is getting organized. There is a corollary to the whole idea of do something. And that corollary is commandment number 2. Don't stop somebody else from doing something.
Yeah.
and it's not that, look, I used to work full-time for the Libertarian Party many moons ago. I spend full-time working on initiative and referendum. I want all of you folks to get involved with what I'm doing. And I think that the solution to that, and obviously I think what I'm doing is the best thing to do. So maybe, you know, I could argue what you're doing isn't the best thing to do. But why? Why argue when instead you can just invite? Instead of trying to convince the other person to stop what they're doing and do what you want them to do, why don't you just invite them to do what you want them to do? Maybe they'll stay up all night doing what they want to do anyway. No harm. No harm. And with that in mind, I want to invite each and every one of you. We're going to pass these out. Everybody has a refrigerator, don't they? Here's a magnet. It's a free gift. You just take one and pass it out. And I invite you, if you're not a subscriber to Common Sense, it's a radio commentary I also send out by email, Monday through Friday, and it talks about all kinds of issues, a lot about initiative and referendum, about term limits, but also a lot about all kinds of issues. Let me give a few more in case we run short. And I invite you to get involved. Part of the problem, if instead of inviting people, we argue with them, is that sometimes we only accomplish the first part of our goal. Our goal is to stop them from doing what they're doing so they can help us do what we're doing. And if we only succeed halfway, we don't get more freedom out of the deal because they just stop doing what they're doing. Let me give the third commandment, which is a little counterintuitive, and that is embrace defeat. Now, when I refused to register for the draft, I had some moments where certainly I didn't feel victorious. I lost in court. Now, I certainly expected to lose in court. But when you're, you know, going into the prison system, you know, when you're going to the showers for the first time, it's a little disconcerting. And you think, you know, maybe this wasn't such a great idea. But to do what you think is right is not always going to be to do what you think is going to be tremendously successful. And oftentimes, you're mistaken even about that. It is oftentimes when you do something, even when you fail, ultimately successful. I think it was Richard Nixon who ran for office 4 times before he was elected. Now, that's probably not our idea of the ultimate success, but it goes to show that you build on your defeats. There's a great Bob Dylan line in One Song or Another where he says, he won the war after losing every battle. Oftentimes, if we pick the right battles, we win whether we win or lose. If we fight the good fight on taxes, on civil liberties, in time, even when we lose, we will win, because we will win people who realize, like so many of my Republican friends say to me, you know, I like the libertarians. They're serious. That's what they say. They're serious, meaning they really believe the stuff they're saying all the time. So sometimes, even when you lose, you win if you keep fighting the battle. And if you're not afraid to lose, you fight battles that you otherwise wouldn't fight, which I think make all the difference. The fourth commandment is a funny one, and one that in my experience, libertarians need to learn maybe more than any other. And that is, accept victory. I was involved with a campaign in Prince William County, Virginia. I think it's the best libertarian campaign. Robert McBride was the candidate, nonpartisan office, county supervisor. I'm a busy guy. I'm usually not looking for some new thing to do. But they kept coming by my door, knocking on my door. I agreed to work the polls on election day. I took the day off. I was just so impressed. I made a very tiny contribution. They called, thanked me, came by to pick up the check. It was the kind of campaign that I was just very proud to have been a part of. And the best campaign I think I've ever seen. He got 19% of the vote. Now, I was working the polls. It's a nonpartisan election. Everyone who came up was offered a Republican ballot and a Democratic ballot. This is a bedroom community of Washington, D.C. Everybody knows everything about the federal government. They couldn't tell you what the street won over, what the name of the street was. They don't know anything about what's happening locally. And almost every single person who came up took either the Republican or the Democratic ballot. I was giving stuff out for Robert. People sometimes would take it, but it was almost like, wait a second, I got the Republican and Democratic ballot. So it was a very partisan election. Robert McBride got 19% of the vote. I went to a party, a little pizza party, about a week or so after the election. And Robert was not there, but other people were. The guy who managed the campaign, who did a tremendous job, and they all had their head in their hands. They'd lost. Now, I mean, we do have to recognize that winning is actually winning the election. We don't want to be silly and say, oh, we won because we got, 7% of the vote, or 19 even. But 19 is a heck of a good showing. And any political realist is going to know that's leverage. That is not slink away, you've been embarrassed. That, to any political professional, is a tremendous victory. When Ross Perot got 19% for president, the Congress for the next 2 years was scared. And trust me, the only way you can stand these people is when they're scared. I see presidential elections, and of course for president we know we're not going to get, more than what, one or two, or if we got in the debates, maybe we get four, we get five, we're not going to win. And yet every single time we have a presidential election, we spend what, 6 months, 9 months, a year beating up the presidential campaign? It's not a sign of clear-headed realism. It's a sign of insanity. Clear-headed realism would appreciate what has been accomplished and move on to accomplish the next thing. So I probably spent more time on arguing for accepting victory than I need to, but I see us beat ourselves up again and again, and not the worst part isn't just that we beat ourselves up. We then don't answer the next bell. When the public, anyone who's paying attention, is waiting for us. I had lunch years ago. I was working on term limits with Don Fetter. And some of you who were involved in the Ron Paul campaign back in 88, which seems like 5 or 6 years ago, but it's a little longer. will remember that Don Fetter wrote a scathing attack on Ron Paul and on libertarians. And of course, we're having lunch and I'm trying to, you know, use the gift of gab and then be personable. We get talking and he asks me what I've been involved in, and I mentioned libertarians, and I'm just waiting for him to, you know, seize on it. And instead he says to me, he said, you know, I don't get libertarians. He says, years ago, there was a campaign here in Massachusetts. A woman who ran for governor, and of course, because it happened to be the first petition drive I ever managed, I knew exactly who he was talking about. It was Rebecca Shipman, who was a social worker by trade and who was a wonderful candidate for Massachusetts and who could explain libertarianism in a way that people who cared about poor and folks who needed help from government could understand. He said she ran a great campaign, and then we never heard from her again. She got, I think, 1% of the vote, and so again, we lost. We slink away, when in reality, someone who had savaged the libertarian philosophy had actually been impressed by that campaign and wondered where it went. Number five, I think, flows right from that, and that is stop looking for silver bullets by which you can blow people away and start planting seeds. The silver bullets never work, and the seeds almost always do. The nice thing about the seeds is that the next day you can plant another one. But people get tired of the silver bullets flinging at them at high speeds. And I think we all know what that's about, and that's right. We've tried, all of us in our own way, we used to call it the libertarian macho flash. But it's we know everything and just listen and you'll find out. Again, if you go back to number one, people have a tendency to watch what you do and not listen so much to what you say. Number six is look for allies. And I think that sometimes we don't. We're so quick to understand the differences that we forget the commonalities. Right now on, any public building of baseball stadiums or what have you, there is a natural coalition with what I would call the Nader left that libertarians ought to be making. And you will win friends and influence people. You'll not only influence policy, you will get friendships that will be helpful later on. When I was involved in a petition drive back in 2006 in Oklahoma to cap state spending and to go after eminent domain abuse, there were two separate measures. I ended up getting in a lot more hot water in Oklahoma than I had wanted. And the Attorney General indicted three of us on a petition drive on a law that ended up being ruled unconstitutional, but we didn't break it in the first place, so it hardly mattered. After a year and a half of having an indictment, and this was a felony indictment for conspiracy to defraud the state, it carried a 10-year prison term. And I guess if they sent me to prison, my wife would have had to pay a $25,000 fine. I thought that was just almost poetic justice, but no, I'm kidding. In the end, after a year and a half, the Attorney General never even allowed us to get to a preliminary hearing. We never had a judge look at the charges and decide there was enough merit to them to have even a trial. But he put us on ice for a year and a half, and I think, of course, that was their goal. But during that battle, all kinds of people stepped up to help me, people that I'd worked with in the past, and a lot of them came from conservative libertarian type backgrounds. But I think one of the things that threw the Attorney General for a loop and led him to start thinking, maybe this isn't such good politics, was when Ralph Nader went into the state and tore into the Attorney General for what he was doing. He compared it to the Jim Crow. He compared it to Jim Crow laws in the South and just ripped Edmondson through Edmondson, who was the Attorney General. Well, it came from a total different, all of a sudden he had opponents on his left, not just his right. Well, the reason I think that Nader did that was, of course, that he agreed with our position, and he was appalled by what the AG did. But it was also because I had a relationship going back for many years working on different issues and looking for ways to get someone who was from a different political perspective on board the effort. Number seven on the Ten Commandment hit parade is to put freedom first and put your own political goals and your organization second. And, you know, that it kind of goes without saying, except, boy, it's the first thing that goes out the window. Because, of course, you know, I run two organizations, Citizens in Charge Advocacy Group, Citizens in Charge Foundation, educational, we do litigation. I've got to make sure that we can do what we are trying to do. I've got to make sure money comes in the door. I've got to make sure the political work happens. I have to make sure that people hear enough about what we're doing that they decide to keep working with us. So, of course, I'm going to be focused on what credit we get. The key for all of us is to be focused on that just one little nanosecond behind what's best for the freedom movement. Our organizations are vehicles to accomplish freedom. Let's put freedom first. The eighth commandment, and you'll see in 8, 9, and 10 that I think there's a real opportunity here in Maryland to make inroads with people of all different political perspectives and to get some good things done that will allow libertarians to be more effective in the future. And I'll wrap that up at the end. 8 is, if you can't beat them at their own game, try winning at your game. And you know, this is a way to say think outside the box. But one thing I would put forward is that I think it's tough to elect libertarian candidates. For one, libertarians, unlike any other political party I'm aware of, runs candidates who tend to believe all down the line in the libertarian philosophy and are not going to be shy about saying this may be unpopular. This may be an issue in which, if I hit it, I could win the election, but I'm not going to hide it. I'm going to run on my philosophy, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it or be dishonest about it. What that means oftentimes is you're not going to win. Now, I'm not saying to do anything different. You got to do what's right. And I'm certainly not saying don't run candidates, because a lot of good things can happen from running candidates. But maybe putting a measure on the ballot through the initiative process that you have in every single county in the state, and in the big populous counties, you've got a cap on the signatures at 10,000 that makes them really pretty easy from a population-based standpoint. If you're in Prince George's or Montgomery County, getting 10,000 signatures is sure a heck of a lot easier than in some of the more rural counties. So this is a process that can be used, and I urge you, look at using that process. There's other ways to do it. As a friend of mine says, there's a great, big, beautiful internet out there. There are all kinds of new ways, and there will be more new ways, and they will come faster and faster for us to get our message out, to connect with people, to find ways to get it done. You know, years ago I remember thinking, they're going to have to privatize the post office at some point. And now I read an article the other day and I started to really feel sorry for the people at the post office. Because they're begging Congress to let them do the right things to try to earn a profit, and they can't get Congress to go along. But the reality is, no, we really didn't have to privatize the post office. It would have been good, but the economy, communication, just leapfrogged them. Just went around them. And went around them so fast that there was no time to privatize them. Now the mail's going down by leaps and bounds every year. The same sorts of things can happen politically. And sometimes, I happen to like school choice. But I homeschool. I say I homeschool. I watch my wife homeschool. And I applaud at all the right times. And she does a good job of it. But it's the kind of thing where we lose. That's been on the ballot again and again and again, and we've lost. Now, there's all kinds of reasons that teachers' unions spend huge dollars, so on and so on. But I submit to some of my friends who have been very involved in those efforts, maybe it's not the way. Maybe there's another way. So as much as we want to embrace defeat, remember number three, we want to also learn from defeat and look for ways. If in the box we can't win, maybe we got to jump out. Number nine is admit that you're a small D Democrat and a small R Republican. One of the, I think, strongest condemnations of the Democrats is how anti-democratic they are. The idea they want, you know, you learn in political theory in college about the vanguard of the proletariat under, communism. In essence, Democrats throughout this country in power want to help the little guy whether he likes it or not. And because he doesn't, they don't want him to have any say-so in it. And that's something that libertarians ought to be pointing out and ought to be working on behalf of those issues. The same's true with Republicans. And you look now about the filibuster and some of these things, you can grab quotes from one side, and when it changes, you know, the circumstances change as to whose ox is going to be gored, you just flip the quotes. In fact, I think one of the saddest things about, you know, when we went into Iraq, I'm convinced that on most foreign policy questions, if it was a Democrat in the White House wanting to do it, you could flip the Democrats and Republicans. If it's a Republican wanting to do it, they flip the other way. What that says is that decisions about the life and death of Americans is made on totally partisan political considerations, and it's frightening. It's horrifying. And it's something that libertarians ought to exploit for your own benefit and for the benefit of the country. We now have two parties that have walked away from a decent heritage that those parties had been established under. And we ought to be the party of real republicanism and real democracy. And I think libertarians have a little bit, republicanism we're okay with. We understand that. But democracy almost scares us, because we want to think about pure democracy and that they're going to vote on everything. That's not what the American people think of when people talk about democracy. That's not at all what they think of. They think about any action government takes that is legitimate under the Constitution. I love Harry Brown's line that I want a government small enough to fit inside the Constitution. I think it's even better than Grover Norquist wanting to drown government in the bathtub. But we as libertarians need to push for when government has a legitimate function, it ought to be decided democratically. The guy without any money ought to have the same power as the guy that has money. The guy without any connections ought to have the same power as the guy that has connections. And that basic fairness will, I think, go a long way in letting people realize what libertarians are really all about. Number 10 is if the process itself prevents you from attacking the problem, the process is the problem. Attack the process. Now, you can look at this a lot of different ways. When I was in Virginia last week at their convention, I singled out Bill Redpath, who not only is on the board of Citizens in Charge Foundation working to try to protect initiative and referendum rights, he also works with Fair Vote, which works on proportional representation and instant runoff voting and some other ideas. I like those ideas, and I like the idea of libertarians getting involved in the process and attacking that process, because I think oftentimes people, you know, years ago when I was doing term limit stuff, we'd sometimes have a fight. For instance, in Wyoming, they passed a term limits initiative with 77% of the vote in November, In January, the legislature was trying to gut that vote. Now, I pointed out to my boss, he said, well, how, you know, we went up on statewide television. He says, what do you think people are going to think? I said, you know, term limits is a 77% issue. But basic fairness and democracy and respect for the public and the voters is about a 98% issue. We couldn't find a list in Wyoming to call, so we had people take the call, the phone bank, the local phone book, and just call the phone book. Because we realized we didn't need a list of pre-identified supporters. It was the entire population that was with us. So attacking the process moves you oftentimes from a 51% or a 58% issue to a 98% or an 88% or what have you. The other thing is that process has to be fixed. If you can't, you know, I've had a lot of respect for National Right to Life, which has an issue, abortion, but has many times taken that issue and put it aside to say, we have to have campaign finance laws that allow us to speak out, or we can't change the public's mind on our critical issue. Whatever you think about that issue or other issues, having a process by which we can bring up change, enact it directly, which is why I love initiative and referendum, but find some way to get in the game, we have to do it. And that's not a, it's not a sidetrack. It's not a diversion from libertarianism. It is part of the essential process to get libertarian policy in place and to let people know what libertarianism is really all about. I think we might have a little bit of time for questions, and I'd be glad to take any I could. I have to say that all of these commandments could be summed up in the first one, which is do something. And I'm convinced that if we do something, good things will happen. I have a friend who years ago made the comment that, you know, we always say if something's worth doing, it's worth doing right. And he said, you know what? If something's worth doing, it's worth doing wrong. And we don't usually think of it that way. But if something's worth doing, do it. If it can't be perfect, then it won't be perfect. Do it. If you do it and you make all kinds of mistakes, do it. Thanks a lot.